Okay, so let us start. We have just finished some of the preliminary readings, just to get a kind of basic ideas about meditation practice, first of all, and a general overview of the path of meditation. And now I want to move on to look more in detail at the Noble Eightfold Path, the Arya Atangika Mago. Before we actually start to look at the details of this path, the individual factors, samaditti all the way to samadhi, I want to look at the path as a whole. What does the path actually mean? How does it kind of fit together? What does the whole thing mean as a complete entity, so to speak? This is the first thing I want to do. Then from there on, maybe tomorrow morning or something, we can start to look at the details of this path. And it's a slightly mysterious path, this Noble Eightfold Path. The first time you see this path, you see these eight factors, right? Right view, right action, right effort. And it's not immediately obvious what all this means. It means like eight different things that we're supposed to do. Is there any connection between these eight things? Do they somehow kind of fit together into an overall scheme? What is going on? It seems like this kind of eight slightly disjointed factors which don't seem to have that much to do with each other. But one of the things that you start to notice once you start to read the suttas is that everything is structured, everything is organized. There's no such thing as kind of this things put together in a random fashion. They're always organized. First of all, there is an overall structure. There's also structure within the thing itself. The individual elements always have a certain relationship to each other. And this is so throughout the suttas, almost all the different categories of suttas from the gradual training. In the gradual training, it's very obvious, right? The anupubba sikha, very obvious that you're moving to more and more profound states, deeper and deeper states. But it's true everywhere. It's true with the Four Noble Truths, it's true with the Noble Eightfold Path, it's true with the Bhujangas, it's true with the Five Khandhas, it's true with the Nivaranas, right? Everything has a structure to it. Everything has a certain sequence. And once you understand the structure and the sequence, you get a much better grasp of what these things actually are about, and how they function, and how they work together. Here's one of the, I think, very important basic things about the Buddha's teaching. If you understand the structure of things, it's actually an interpretive idea, or an interpretive tool to use when we read the suttas, to understand that there's a structure there. And very often the structure is from basic things to more profound things, early parts of the path to later aspects of the path. That's usually how the structure works. And once you know that, actually interpreting the suttas becomes much easier. So this is what I will look at now on this Noble Eightfold Path itself. What is the overall structure of this? How does the whole thing kind of hold together as a complete thing? And once you understand that, it's also easier to know what you're supposed to be doing. So this is not just theory, it's actually very practical at the same time. So let's have a look at this particular sutta which comes up next. It's called Ignorance. This is Avijja in Pali. It's from the Samyutta Nikaya 45. This is the Magga Samyutta, and it's the first sutta of the Magga Samyutta. And the Magga Samyutta, of course, is the Magga here, is the Arya Atangika Magga. So this is about the Noble Eightfold Path. So being the first sutta, it stands at the beginning, it has a certain significance. It kind of gives you the definition, the understanding of what the path is all about. So that is obviously quite significant for that reason. Ignorance, avidya, the Pali, the opposite of avidya, of course, is vidya. And the word vidya in Pali, it's not really ignorance. The opposite of ignorance is like knowledge, right? Ignorance means that you don't really know, you don't understand, you're ignorant about certain facts usually. But this, of course, is not about facts. It's about the deep and direct insight and understanding into reality. So ignorance may not be such a good translation. Maybe delusion might be a suitable translation, right? Delusion, you don't understand. Or perhaps even, I think Ajahn Brahm sometimes likes the word illusion, because you're seeing things in a way which aren't actually true. So it's like an illusion. you're seeing a self where there is no self, right? This sort of thing. So delusion and illusion, especially delusion perhaps, might be a good translation for avidya. So perhaps that should be the title for this sutta. I don't mean to kind of improve on Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a very good translator, and I would say I have worked with him a little bit, and he is very careful. He always looks at his points with, you know, he checks all the sources, and he does everything in a very careful and deliberate manner. And that is wonderful that we have such translators around the world. When he translates the Samyutta Nikaya, it takes him 10 years to translate the Samyutta Nikaya, right? It's a very slow and ponderous and very, it's very well done. But it's important to remember that regardless of how good you are as a translator here, there's always going to be, every translation is going to have certain weaknesses and certain strengths, right? Because you have to make choices. And if you choose one thing here, it's going to have a certain weakness. If you choose the opposite, that is going to have a certain weakness. So you cannot have a translation which is all strengths all the way through. Every translation, regardless of what you choose, is going to have some weaknesses. So if I do kind of try to look at things in different ways, it's not because I'm really complaining about the translation, I'm just trying to show a different angle of some of these things. So, ignorance. I'll start reading out this particular sutta on the Noble Eightfold Path. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," those bhikkhus replied, and the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, ignorance or delusion is the forerunner in the entry upon unwholesome states, with shamelessness and fearlessness of wrongdoing following along. For an unwise person immersed in ignorance, wrong view springs up. For one of wrong view, wrong intention springs up. For one of wrong intention, wrong speech springs up. For one of wrong speech, wrong action springs up. For one of wrong action, wrong livelihood springs up. For one of wrong livelihood, wrong effort springs up. For one of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness springs up. For one of wrong mindfulness, wrong stillness springs up. Because true knowledge, or true insight, if you like, is the forerunner in the entry upon wholesome states, with a sense of shame and fear of wrongdoing following along. For a wise person who has arrived at true insight, right view springs up. For one of right view, right intention springs up. For one of right intention, right speech springs up. For one of right speech, right action springs up. For one of right action, right livelihood springs up. For one of right livelihood, right effort springs up. For one of right effort, right mindfulness springs up. And for one of right mindfulness, right stillness springs up. So there you are. So there, straight away, what you see there when you read that is you see that there is a connection between every factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? There is a sequence there, one thing leading to the next one. This is not the only sutta which shows that. You see that in a number of places, that there is this sequence, one thing leading to the next one. And of course, this is the a crucial insight you need to have to understand the overall structure and the overall purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path. Once you understand the sequence, once you understand that one factor leads to another one, and that is kind of the key, if you like, to understanding what is going on here. And then the whole thing kind of unravels and comes apart in a beautiful way once we see that. But before I talk about that in detail, let us have a look at some of the things at the very beginning here, just very briefly. The first thing the Buddha says is that ignorance is the forerunner in the entry upon wholesome states. Right? Ignorance, in other words, delusion is the delusion always go first. Once there is delusion, then unwholesome things start to happen as a consequence. Unwholesomeness, badness, you know, bad states of mind, this happens as a consequence of ignorance. You don't know what is going on. And for that reason, you make mistakes and you go in the wrong way. Unwholesome states, the Pali for this is akusala dhamma. States here is a translation of Dhamma, which is, again, I'm going to go into some detail, which perhaps sometimes I don't go into, because I think some of these issues are interesting, right? Aspects of translation, how to translate properly. And I hope this interests you, because for me at least, it is very important, some of these details. So the idea of the word state in English means like a certain thing. It's almost, it's something that is very, very real in a sense. A state is a particular thing here. And the reason why Bhikkhu Bodhi translates Dhamma as state in this way here is very much related to the way that the word Dhamma is used in the Abhidhamma. In the Abhidhamma, you have all the Dhammas, right? The Chetasikas and all these other things. This is the Dhamma theory of the Abhidhamma. And these things are kind of things, right? All the various Dhammas are defined in certain very precise ways. And these are the constituents of reality according to the Abhidhamma. Reality has only so many constituents, and these are like the states, these are the Dhammas of which reality or the world or our experience is built up. And this is why Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as states in this way here. And basically, it is a translation that is taken from Abhidhamma philosophy here. Abhidhamma is an extension in a sense of the suttas, and it's a separate kind of class of philosophy, if you like. Yeah. So for that reason, I think that sometimes what Bhikkhu Bodhi is doing here, in my opinion, is kind of bringing a little bit of Abhidhamma idea into the suttas by translating in this way. But I think it is very important that when we translate a word like Dhamma, because it has different meanings in the suttas from what it has in the Abhidhamma, it's important that we stay with the sutta meaning. What is the sutta meaning of the word Dhamma? And one of the main meanings, it has actually many meanings in the suttas, but one of the main meanings in the suttas is the qualities of the mind, right? You have a certain Dhamma, it's a quality in the mind. So, these qualities come and go. They're not really states, they're not kind of things which have a very defined nature. They're not always the same. Exactly how they arise will vary depending on cause and conditions. But there are certain qualities that tend to arise. And these can be divided into wholesome ones, right, that leads towards awakening, and the unwholesome ones that lead away from awakening. So for that reason, I think that something like quality in this case would be a better translation for Dhamma than the word state, which is too solid, which kind of applies an existing entity in a certain way, perhaps. So ignorance is the forerunner in entry upon unwholesome qualities, or for the acquiring of unwholesome qualities, with shamelessness and fearlessness of wrongdoing following along here. And shamelessness and fearlessness of wrongdoing, these two words are, of course, the hiri otapa, right? Otapa, which is fear of wrongdoing, is the understanding that if I do certain things, it will have bad consequences, right? You make bad karma of the three types, and because you make bad karma, then consequences are bad. So you are a bit concerned about that, and you withhold the bad actions because you know the consequences of that. So that is fearlessness of wrongdoing here. And you can see how that obviously fits in with the idea of delusion here. If you are deluded, you lose that fearlessness of wrongdoing here because you don't understand that there are consequences of the bad things that you do. Then there is shamelessness, right? If you have wrong understanding, you're also shameless. And that is not so obvious why that is the case. Why does a bad understanding lead to shamelessness? And I'm not entirely clear myself why that actually should be the case, but I suspect it has something to do with the fact that if you have right view, you want to purify yourself, and you see negative qualities in yourself, you feel kind of repelled by it, right? To have a sense of shame means you feel impure when you see these things inside of yourself, and you feel repelled by the fact that you have these negative qualities there. You feel, oh, I'm not worthy. I'm too good for having these negative qualities. That is, in a sense, how you feel. You feel better than these things, and therefore you have a sense of shame when these negative things arise in your mind. But it's interesting. It basically means that shame itself is like constructed through view, right? If you have right view, that is when you have shame. If you got wrong view, you become this shameless character. You don't really feel bad, even though you're doing bad things. And of course, that is very bad, right? If you don't feel bad, when you should feel bad, that is bad. So you have to, because when you feel shame, it is like the thing which will drive you in the right direction. If you don't even feel shame, there isn't much hope. There's nothing to block you from going in the wrong direction. And that is why avidya is such a very difficult thing here and very big problem. And then comes one of the interesting things here. Then the Buddha says, for an unwise person immersed in delusion, wrong view springs up as a consequence. Wrong view comes as a consequence of delusion. Right? Now, wrong view and delusion are basically the same thing, right? A wrong view is defined on the Noble Eightfold Path as not understanding the Four Noble Truths, right? Delusion, avidya, is also defined at the beginning of dependent origination as not understanding the Four Noble Truths, not having the insight into the Four Noble Truths. So they are the same thing. So one thing leads to the other. So what this is saying is that not understanding the Four Noble Truths leads to not understanding the Four Noble Truths. That's what it's saying, right? One thing leads to another one. And this is the problem with delusion. The problem with delusion is that delusion actually feeds delusion. Delusion leads to more delusion. And that is why we are trapped. This is precisely the whole point of samsara. And the problem with samsara is that once you are deluded, it is self-perpetuating. It propels itself forward, you know, from life to life, from year to year, from time to time. It just keeps on going. So there you can start straight away. You see this. So it's frightening, isn't it, when you see that? Delusion leads to more delusion. That means you are trapped. There's no way out. So what that means also then is that for this reason, it is why it is so important to have the Kalyanamitta. Because the Kalyanamitta is the person who tells you, listen, you are deluded. There is a problem here. You need to look at this in a different way. If that Kalyanamitta doesn't come, you cannot break out, because delusion leads to more delusion. Kalyanamitta is absolutely necessary. And as you will see in a later sutta, this is why the Buddha says that the Kalyanamitta is not 50% of the life, Ananda, it is 100% of the holy life, right? That's why he says that, because without that as a basis, there is no breaking out of the cycle of delusion, driving delusion onwards, again and again and again, from life to life, from existence to existence, from whatever it is. So that is, I think, quite interesting and important for understanding how self-perpetuating this samsara actually is. Now, then we have this idea that from wrong view you get wrong intention, right? And then from wrong intention you get all these other wrong things. So if your view of the world is wrong, then you start aiming in the wrong direction because you can't see what's going on. So you aim in the wrong way, right? You're aiming towards suffering, basically. That is what the wrong way is in Buddhism. So, and to give you an idea of what this means, now, I usually like very kind of practical and down-to-earth examples. Now, say as a lay person, you are going to the shops, right? But you are living in a new place. You don't know where the shops are. Now, the shop is to the left, but you have the view that the shop is to the right. That's a wrong view, right? It's a very kind of silly wrong view and very kind of basic wrong view. It still is wrong view. So, I was just saying this idea of right view and the way it fits with delusion here and how it moves on into right intention and then the right activity or action on the path. And I was saying it's a bit like if you're a householder and you want to go to the shop, you're living in a new place, you don't know where the shop is, the shop is actually to the left, but you are going to the right. So what that means, you have wrong view. So because you have wrong view, you go to the I was mixing up my hands here. So now it gets all wrong. But say the shop is to the right, but you're going to the left. Now, if you are going to the left, it means that you have wrong intention, right? Your aim is wrong. You're going in the wrong direction. And because your aim is wrong, your action is wrong. You're then moving towards a place where you will not find the shop you're looking for. And what is the result of that? The result is a certain degree of suffering. You get there, you walk on, and perhaps you don't find the shop you think is further down the road, and eventually you get lost perhaps, and who knows what happens as a consequence, and you can't find your apartment, I don't know what might happen next. All kind of problems arise from wrong view, and then you suffer. And that is the basic idea. From wrong view comes the wrong aim, comes the wrong activity, and then suffering arises as a consequence. And right view, of course, is the exact opposite. You know that the shop is on the to the right, your aim is to walk to the right, your activity, your action is to walk to the right, and eventually you get to the shop, and you get a slight amount of happiness, or at least you avoid the suffering, right? Which is the same as happiness. Happiness and suffering are just opposite sides of the same coin. So if you avoid suffering, that also is a kind of happiness. Right? So this is how right view always transforms into happiness, in one way or another, however you define that happiness. And wrong view always must transform somehow into suffering as a consequence. And you can think of many worldly ways in which this applies, right? Same thing if you invest on the stock market, right? You put your money into the stock market, you get some bad advice, it means you have wrong view. So eventually you get the wrong intention, wrong action, and you end up with losing money as a consequence, you have suffering. Yeah. But these are small things, right? Whether you lose a bit of money on the stock market or you go to the wrong place, you don't reach the shop where you want to go to, it's kind of tiny little things in life. But what we are talking about now, we're talking about right view on a very, very large scale. We're talking about right view about life itself, about how the mind functions, how the world works. We're talking about right view of our entire, basically the right view of what existence is all about, right? The very purpose and very meaning of life itself. What is experience all about? Experience and existence being basically interchangeable, huh? Right? So it's a very, very big picture. And of course, if you misunderstand the nature of existence, the nature of experience, the nature of life itself, then you have a serious problem because you will aim in the wrong way. And that misunderstanding, aiming in the wrong way, just like going to the wrong shop, leads then to the wrong activities, right? The speech, activity, effort, sati, etc., all the wrong activity. And because it leads to all the wrong activity, you end up suffering as a consequence. In exactly the same way, wrong view, because you're making the wrong decisions at the beginning, it must lead away from happiness. Whereas right view is then the exact opposite, because you have a grasp of the nature of existence, a grasp of how the universe works, what existence, what experience is all about, you can aim in the right way, and then you can start moving in accordance with that view, in accordance with that aim, and the result will be happiness, contentment, peace. Ultimately, it will be nibbana, will be the consequence of that. So this is what right view means. Right view, all it really means. Sometimes people complain, oh, I don't like the idea of right view. It's like there's some kind of police saying, this is right view, this is wrong view. You have to follow what I say, and this is, you know, this is bad. But it's not about that. It's not about somebody policing you and telling you, you have to believe this. What it is aligning your view in accordance with reality. That is what it's all about. Reality is often hidden from us. We can't see reality. We are deluded. We don't understand whether there is rebirth or not. We don't understand whether there's karma or not. And because we can't see these things, that is the problem. So it's just about seeing things in accordance with reality. That is what right view is all about. It's not about kind of imposing some kind of doctrine from above, saying, this is what you must believe. That is not what it means. So that is just to give you some idea of this whole, how this works, right? This idea of wrong view and why wrong view is such a massive problem that it then leads to the entire development of this wrong Noble Eightfold Path, all the way up to Miccha Samadhi, which is the last one of these factors. What is Mitra Samadhi? It sounds strange that there can't be such a thing as Mitra Samadhi, right? What is Mitra Samadhi? Wrong stillness. Either you're still or you're not, right? How can you have wrong stillness? What does it mean? And what it means, I think, is that stillness, which is based either on right view or wrong view, if you have stillness based on wrong view, then it's called Mitra Samadhi. If you have stillness based on right view, then it's called Samma Samadhi. You will see this in a few places in the suttas. You will see the definition of Samma Samadhi, and it's defined as Samadhi, which has the support of the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? And of course, the clue here, the most important one, is the first one, Samma Ditti, because that is the first one on this whole thing here. So, because we are dealing with a sequence of things here, just like we were talking about this morning, we're talking about the sequence of states of mind that leads towards samadhi. It's the same thing we're seeing here. We're saying a sequence of things, one thing leading to the next one. Now, if you want a sequence or a causal sequence of phenomena, if you want that to arise, you want to strengthen that, the first one, just like this morning, sila was the important one, here, ditti, samaditti is the important one, right? Because that is the base, that is the foundation. And the stronger that samaditti is, or the stronger the michaditti is, either the more powerful will be the path, or the weaker will be the path. And this is why, for the stream enter has the perfect samaditti, the sotapanna, that is why for them, it will be natural, right? The practice will be easy, natural, because you have seen everything. And that is why they will have to attain awakening at a certain stage. So for this reason, because the idea of ditti is so important, I would like to spend some time on samaditti on this retreat, maybe a day or two at least, maybe a couple of sessions at least, on samaditti, to investigate that in more detail. Because once you then, the more powerfully that is established, the more powerful should the practice of the path become as a consequence of that. Just like this morning we're talking about sila, now we're talking about the power of view itself. Okay, let us look at the other side of this equation, the arising of the right factors of the path. So now, because true knowledge is the forerunner in the entry upon wholesome qualities, right? True knowledge being vijja, literally being here the opposite of delusion, so being like awakening or being insight, right? Understanding, wisdom. These are the vijja, these are wisdoms, these are understandings on the path. But again, profound understandings would have to do with insight. So you could actually translate vijja as insight. That would be perfectly acceptable translation. Knowledge, I think, again, knowledge is the kind of stuff you get at university, right? People tell you, oh yeah, this is the history of the world, and you kind of take it in. This is not very different from that. It's not that kind of knowledge at all. It's a profound thing that deals with insight. So it is insight. And of course, vijja, insights in Buddhism, are very specific. You can talk about insight in many different ways. But the vijjas are three specific insights. The te vijja, and that is, of course, the recollection of past lives, the understanding of how karma drives the destiny of beings, and the last one, which is the penetration of the Four Noble Truths, which is basically the gaining of arahantship. These are the real kind of insights in Buddhism, and this is what is, in part, is what is meant here by these things, right? So it is interesting. I mean, sometimes, and I think this is kind of probably worth talking about, as always we talk about ideas of rebirth and, you know, the modern view by some modern Buddhists, they kind of reject the idea of rebirth. But actually, from the Buddha's point of view, the rebirth is one of the true knowledges, one of the real insights that you have on the path. It is absolutely foundational, right? This is the kind of stuff which actually makes you an awakened person. These are the things that makes the Noble Eightfold Path work. Is at the very foundation of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the more you understand how integral the idea of rebirth is to the Buddha's teachings, and now this is something I will point out as we go along, because it may not be so obvious, but it's absolutely integral to the Four Noble Truths, to the Eightfold Path, to dependent arising, to all of these most central teachings in Buddhism, it is there all along. You can't really take it out. If you take it out, you know, it's the whole thing just collapses and there's nothing left. It's important to know that, you know, I mean, whether people believe in rebirth or not is kind of, that's up to them. But at the very least, we need to establish that it is an important part of the Buddha's teaching here. So this is really what the Te Vidya are about. And once you gain a certain amount of understanding of these things, a certain amount of understanding of the Noble Truths, a certain confidence in the ideas of rebirth and karma in particular. And of course, remember that there are levels of understanding here, right? There is the initial confidence that you have in these things. Confidence will increase. You start to get some insight and understanding until eventually one day you get the full understanding of what these things are about. Sometimes people talk about either you have right view or wrong view, but the reality is not as simple as that. Usually we are kind of somewhere in between. Only the stream enter has fully right view. Who has fully wrong view? Well, it's very few people who have absolutely wrong view. I mean, maybe there are some who say, you know, doing bad is the best thing you can do. Everybody should go around doing bad and killing and hurting and stealing and these kind of things. That is the right way to live the world. You know, my God tells me that I must do bad things. But this is quite rare. Most people, I think, have some feeling that being good, being kind, being generous is a positive thing in this world. And so most of us, we're somewhere in between. We haven't got really wrong view, we haven't got right view, we're somewhere in between this kind of a spectrum there. So one of our jobs is then to move further towards right view, to strengthen the right view. And by doing that, we are strengthening the foundation for the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so once you have you have the entry upon wholesome states, right? Is it especially true for the stream enter? But it's true for everyone who has some degree of true knowledge. Then you get the sense of shame. You get the fear of wrongdoing. You understand the consequences of your actions, right? And for the wise person who has arrived at true insight, vidya, right view springs up. You have right view. You see things in accordance with the reality. The world functions in a certain way, right? Either there is rebirth or there isn't. And now you're seeing things in the way that the world actually works. Obviously very important. Then, when you have that, then you get sammasankappa, the right aim. Sammasankappa is often translated as right intention. But the word right intention can mean different things. It can mean either that you have, you know, a good intention of metta or karuna in your heart. You don't have ill will or whatever. But it can also mean that your aim or purpose in life is right, right? So you're now aiming for the right thing. You understand that there is a problem. You understand that if I do bad, there will be bad consequences. You understand that, you know, this samsara is not really worth going on, so you want to find an escape of these things. And for that reason, you get the right aim. And this is really here what happens as a right view. You're aiming. Your purpose becomes right. This is an alternative translation to right intention. It's not that right intention is wrong. It's just that this gives you an additional angle on which to view this from. And then, when you have right intention, then you start off by purifying yourself, right? And the purification factors of right speech, right action, right livelihood, these are all about purifying our morality. Right? Once you understand the danger in samsara, once you understand that you are tied to the wheel of samsara by craving, by the defilements of the mind, you want to abandon those defilements because you understand that this is what actually binds you. It is said in the suttas that we are fettered by craving, right? What is that in Pali? Tanha sangyojana or something like that. You are fettered by craving. Craving is what binds you. It's what glues you to the round of rebirth. As long as you have craving, you are glued. So once you see that, to some extent at least, of course, you want to purify yourself. And this is the beginning of that path of purification. And now you start to understand how the Noble Eightfold Path works, right? You have to purify yourself. You start to see that the samsara, you are bound to this pointless running around, this endless wheel of suffering going on and on and on. This is what understanding rebirth is all about. then you aim to purify yourself in such a way that that thing which grips you, holds you on, fetters you, binds you to that wheel of rebirth, that is weakened. That craving, that anger, all those defilements that bind you, they are starting to weaken. And this is why you want to purify yourself. You understand that the path of Buddhism is really the path of purification. Right? The Visuddhimagga. But you don't need to go to the Visuddhimagga. It is right here in the suttas. This is also the no way for path is the Visuddhimagga, if you like. Yeah. So you have the Visuddhimagga right there. Yeah. And, yes. So then, of course, you purify yourself through the right actions, the right speech, the right livelihood. We can talk about these things later on in detail. Now I'm just talking about it in very general terms. And then from all the right morality comes, of course, the right vayama, the right effort. Samma vayama, right effort. Why is that? Well, the reason is because once you have the right morality, once your actions and your speech are roughly in line with what they should be to purify yourself, then you have to move on to the mind. The mind is more difficult to purify. It takes more refinement. It takes more skillful use of thinking, of perception, of yoniso manasikara, and all these things had to be more refined. This is a more difficult level. You're purifying first the coarse things, then you are purifying the more refined things. That is why right effort comes after right action and right speech and right livelihood. Then, once you have purified your mind to a certain extent, then comes sammasati, right mindfulness, right? So what then is right mindfulness all about? And this is one of the things I want to talk about as well on this retreat, to understand what right mindfulness actually is about, what the purpose is. And to understand that, you know that after right mindfulness, you have right samadhi. So right mindfulness, sammasati, is squeezed in between sammavayama or sammapadana and sammasamadhi on the one hand. It is this last thing which comes towards the very end of the Noble Eightfold Path. So, you have right effort, then you have right samadhi, and sammasati is in between. So what does that mean? Well, what it means is that sammasati is the last thing that you do before you enter sammasamadhi. It's the last thing that takes you to real samadhi. The purpose of sammasati is to take you to samadhi. That is the purpose of it. Right? And this is what you can see here. You can see that one thing leading to the next one. If you apply your sati in the right way, it will lead to samadhi. How does it lead to samadhi? Well, sammapadana, which is the right effort of purifying the mind, once you have done that right effort to a certain extent, there are still very refined defilements left in the mind. And those refined defilements that are still there, they are the things that are abandoned towards the very end, before you can enter samadhi. Because to enter samadhi, your mind has to be 100% pure, right? No nivaranas, no defilements can remain. So this is the purpose of sammasati. Now, if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, you will understand that that must be true. Satipatthana Sutta talks about the pancha nivarana, right? In the Dhammanupassana section, the last section of Satipatthana is the contemplation of the pancha nivarana, and it says that you're supposed to know when the nivarana is there, you know what causes it to arise, right? You know what stops it from arising in the future, right? This is the contemplation of the five hindrances in the Satipatthana Sutta. And of course, the whole purpose of that, to understand these hindrances in such a way, is so that you can abandon them completely. The point is that these are very refined things. It takes a very profound insight even to be able to abandon these defilements as they are. And then Satipatthana takes you from there, and it takes you all the way to samadhi as a consequence. So this is important, right? I mean, we often when we talk about Satipatthana practice, we talk about people who say, oh, Satipatthana is all about its vipassana practice and all these kind of things. But the reality is that Satipatthana, you cannot really say it is sammata or vipassana. Satipatthana is both sammata and vipassana. It is not one or the other. And when you read the Satipatthana Sutta carefully, when you understand how Satipatthana functions on the Noble Eightfold Path between Sammapadana and Sammasamadhi, then you can see that it has both of those aspects to it. It's both about insight and about karma. In fact, the whole Noble Eightfold Path is about those two aspects, insight and karma. Everything you do leads to two things, samatha and vipassana, calm and insight going all the way. And this is the way how I like to understand samatha vipassana and how it seems to me that they are explained in the suttas. They are the results of the practice, right? As you practice in the right way. The Buddha never really says you should practice and says this is a vipassana practice. He doesn't say that. What he says is that you practice in this way, two things result, samatha and vipassana. And this is what happens as you do practice all the factors of this Noble Eightfold Path. And then, as a consequence of that, when the purity of the mind reaches its peak and all the nivarana have disappeared, then sammasamadhi becomes possible as a consequence. And now it is very clear, right, what the Noble Eightfold Path really is. What it is the Visuddhi Magga. That's what it is. It is the path to purity. This is the real Visuddhi Magga, if you like, or perhaps the original Visuddhi Magga. And then there's a later Visuddhi Magga. But this is like the first one. And it is a step-by-step guidance on how to purify yourself from the beginning all the way to the end, till you attain the actual jhana stage as such. So that is the overview, and it's important to understand that it's a path of purity. If you know how pure you are, where are your defilements, what are your problems, then you know roughly what kind of practice you should be doing, right? Are you ready for Satipatthana practice, which actually is quite profound? What have you left to do according to right effort, Sammapadana? Right? You know that somewhere along the spectrum of purification, each one of us is somewhere along that spectrum. And then we have to find out where we are and practice with that in mind. So, there you are, Noble Eightfold Path and the various, how it all adds up and how it basically is a path of purification. And once you see that, the whole thing makes sense. It sticks together very nicely and it leads in the right direction. Now maybe one other thing I should mention before I move on to the next sutta. The next sutta is quite simple, so it won't take very long, but one more thing I should mention which is interesting about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it ends with Sammasamadhi. It's the last one, right? And people say, but what about wisdom? You know, when we talk about other things like the five faculties, you have samadhi, and then you have panya afterwards. What about the wisdom element? How come that is not mentioned in the Noble Eightfold Path? Shouldn't that be there? Right? How can it end with sammasamadhi? And I think the answer to that, is, like as we saw earlier on this morning, is that once you have samadhi, then the result of having samadhi is yathabhuta jnanadasana, right? If you have samadhi, you see things as they actually really as according to reality. So samadhi is enough. And once you have samadhi, the seeing in accordance with reality happens as a consequence of that. And of course, that seeing in accordance with reality is basically what stream entry is all about. And again, we will see that in the next sutta here. So the point is, the work to be done really ends once you come to Sammasamadhi. Sammasamadhi is so profound, and if it is based on right view, then the other things happen more or less automatically as a consequence of that. And because they happen more or less automatically, you don't really need much effort beyond that. And these things happen as a matter of course. But it certainly is interesting that it ends with Samadhi in this way, and it's And I suppose for many it is a bit unexpected. Okay, so that is the Noble Eightfold Path, kind of the big overview. And over the next few days we're going to have to look at these things in much greater detail. Now I want to move on to the next sutta. And this is Sanyutta Nikaya 56.1. This is the Satcha Sanyutta, the Sanyutta of the Four Noble Truths. And this is the first sutta there. And this is how it goes. At Sāvatthī, and this is the Buddha speaking to the monks, bhikkhus, develop stillness. A bhikkhu who is stilled understands things according to reality. And what does he understand, or what does he have insight into according to reality? He has insight according to reality. This is suffering. He has insight according to reality. This is the origin of suffering. He has insight according to reality. This is the ending or cessation of suffering. He has insight according to reality. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Bhikkhus, develop stillness. A bhikkhu who is stilled understands things and has insight into things according to reality. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So, the purpose of this sutta, the reason why I have included this little sutta, is simply to show you that not only is there a forward movement on the Noble Eightfold Path, right? By forward movement, I mean each factory leading to the one afterwards, right? Is a kind of forward conditionality. That forward conditionality is by far the most important one, and that is the one which shows you the sequence in which these factors have to be practiced. If there's no right view, nothing can happen on the Noble Eightfold Path. But the point of this sutta is to show that there is more to it than forward conditionality. There's also like a feedback happening. And that feedback here shows you that when the samadhi starts to arise, that feeds back into right view. This is what understanding things according to reality means, right? It feeds back to right view again. And in this case, the right view here is really the right view of stream entry. Perhaps doesn't have to be fully stream entry, but usually this means stream entry. So once samadhi arises, and you keep on practicing samadhi enough, samadhiti gets stabilized according to the samadhiti of a stream entry. And this is one of the other things about the Noble Eightfold Path, which is interesting. There's actually a couple of different things here, but the first one is that as the higher factors start to mature, as the mind becomes more pure through sammapadana, as the sati becomes strong and you start to develop the satipatthanas, this affects the other factors, the previous factors of the path, right? The more sati you have, the more ability you have to do sense restraint. Sense restraint is that the indriya samvara. Indriya samvara is difficult if sati is very weak. And you find certain places in the suttas where indriya samvara is only perfected when sati is established. So there is the feedback loop, and this is another important thing to remember. So as the first factors become strong, right, and then you start to get mindfulness, the mind becomes more clear, the mind becomes more bright, your ability to deal with the previous things, ability to deal with the mind, to deal with your sila, all that becomes so much more powerful. And this is the beauty of this path. It's not just a forward movement. It's like all of these factors growing together, right? And everything becomes more powerful in one go. Mindfulness, virtue, speech, intention, everything grows together. And even view, as you develop this path, even the right view at the beginning becomes more stronger. Why is that? Because as the path develops, as you start to abandon things, as your meditation becomes more deep, you start to understand the nature of suffering. And this is what we will see, especially when we come to the Anapanasati Sutta. You can see how your understanding grows with each step of Anapanasati, with each step of meditation experience. Your right view at the very foundation becomes more powerful as a consequence. So the most important conditionality on this Noble Eightfold Path is from the beginning to the end, but there's also this important feedback loop as well here. That is all I wanted to show, just to give a more complete exposition of how this path works, as far as I can see anyway here. And of course, another second factor which is important here, again, is this idea that it is the person who has samadhi that sees things in accordance with reality, right? So samadhi is like the clue. This is something you see again and again in the suttas. Samadhi is the clue. Samadhi is the thing that is required for this movement towards the full understanding of things as they actually are, or according to reality here. And the Buddha says that, therefore, an exertion should be made to understand these things. That exertion, then, is the exertion to get still, right? Remember again, the exertion to be still is actually letting go. It's the exertion to let go and to allow everything to become peaceful and calm. That is the exertion that is basically talked about in this particular case. So, that is pretty much it. That is about 1 hour gone already. It's hard to believe how quickly these things go, but 1 hour disappeared. And hopefully it has been an hour well spent. That is the overview of the Noble Eightfold Path, like taking a bird's eye view, understanding the whole process as a path of purification, a gradual purification, until eventually you reach the final stillness of the path. I will stop there, because now from here on we are moving into the individual factors of the path, and that will have to be a topic for tomorrow morning. And then we will meet again here this evening.